Good. So, good morning, everybody. This is week 4 of session 9. One of the things that I've already mentioned and has been very striking to me as I go back through this material, and of course, you know, every time I go back through material like the space section of dynamics, I learn something new, I realize something new. It's always completely different, really, in a sense. But one of the things that has really been striking me is that it's so carefully constructed. It's maybe not so obvious when you read it the first time. I don't remember my previous readings. But there's this very beautiful structure that Rinpoche is unfolding here. And the basic theme, and I've called attention to this before, is really is that we live in a world in which we accept the reality of substance, we accept the reality of the things that we identify and give identities to, including our own identity, and that keeps coming up again and again, that same theme. We accept those realities, and the result is that we live in a very limited world. It's the world that we have identified, and it gives us many possibilities, but it closes down perhaps even greater possibilities. And what Rinpoche is exploring in this space section of dynamics is how we can counteract that by going back, by waking up to space, or bringing space alive, or activating space, or connecting to space. Space is a missing dimension. It's a lost dimension. And in a certain sense, you could say time is also a missing dimension, but we don't have to go into that right now. Our focus is on how we can connect with space, with the idea that when we do, we also reconnect with a possibility for a very rich and very powerful kind of freedom. And that's what we're exploring. So, in this chapter, there's a suggestion made right in the title for how we could approach space, or maybe it's better to say how we could free ourselves from our commitment to the world of substance that we've created through names and labels. And that's by returning to the nameless. That's the title of the chapter. And the analysis here is really important. The discussion here is really important because there's something very appealing to that idea of returning to the nameless, but as Rinpoche is always pointing out in TSK, we may not really understand clearly how to do that, or the ways we think we have in place for doing that, or have available to us for doing that, may not work in the way that we really think that they do. And a lot of this chapter is given over to discussing that particular aspect. So we have a sense that if we could just let go of all the naming, let go of all the labeling, we would free ourselves from a lot of from the limitations that kind of close us in. And we want to see what that means. So let me start by just laying that out a little bit. I think it's very intuitive, or it's not the right word really. Most of us kind of take it for granted that by always relying on the names that things have, instead of being able in some sense to go to a more immediate experience of something, we that by relying on names in that way, we lose something essential. And that understanding underlies a lot of the interest in meditative traditions. But I want to go back and point to a different aspect of our Western culture where that understanding, in a sense, really comes from. The point has been made, and I think it's a really interesting point for people who are involved in Buddhism or who have some experience with Buddhism and Buddhist meditation or other religious traditions, but right now we'll focus on Buddhism. The point is often made that the kind of Buddhism, the kind of understanding we have of Buddhism, is very much influenced by certain aspects of our own Western tradition, which for the most part trace back to Romanticism. And there's a nice article that you can find on the web by a Western monk named Bhikkhu Tanissaro, who starts off a little essay on this point, and he says, when people come to Buddhism, they're often very amazed to find out how some of the ideas in Buddhism, some of the ways of understanding, seem so intuitively right. We just can immediately connect with them. And he says that shouldn't be a surprise, because what we're actually connecting to is something in our own culture that is a kind of a thread that comes to our own culture, and it's this thread of Romanticism. And that, in fact, many of the important Buddhist teachers of especially the first half of the 20th century, let's say, presented Buddhism in terms that were drawn a lot from Romanticism, because that seemed to be a way to connect. So in Romanticism, we have this idea that the truth is only found in silence. That is to say, it's when you stop talking, when you stop turning everything into chatter or ideas, that you gain the ability to access the truth. And there are a couple of things I want to point to, partly because I just found it really interesting in preparing for the class today. Going into these, I found them really fascinating. Nice isn't the right word. Let me back up a little bit. So probably the most important, or one of the two or three most important philosophers of the 20th century, was an Austrian named Ludwig Wittgenstein. Wittgenstein is always associated with analytic philosophy, very much with analyzing words and language, and that's how people understand him. But Wittgenstein himself was a much more complicated figure. There's a very interesting, pretty long biography of him if you look him up on Wikipedia, and that's partly what I'm basing myself on. So Wittgenstein wrote, in his lifetime, he really only published one book, and it was only 75 pages long. But it had a revolutionary effect, and it was called Logical Investigations. So the title is enough to give you an idea. He really wanted to lay out the logic behind our understanding and the way we use language. But at the very end of the book, the very last sentence in the book, Wittgenstein says, and it's so nice in German that I'm going to quote it in German and then I'll translate it. He says, wovon man nicht sprechen kann, darüber muss man schweigen. I say that for the German speakers who are tuned in here to this talk. So in English, a very loose translation, because an accurate translation sounds very stiff. There are things of which one cannot speak. Only silence will do. And Wittgenstein struggled with that. You know, he spent much of his life sort of laying out the way that language and words work, but he always had this sense that there were deeper truths. And it's very interesting. Wittgenstein is such an interesting person. I realized this more in reading this long biography in Wikipedia. You know, at the time that he wrote this, he had given up philosophy. He didn't even have a degree. He didn't have an undergraduate degree in philosophy, but he was very much a genius. He had I don't want to go into too much detail, but he left home and he became a school teacher, a primary school teacher. And for a while he worked as a gardener. He really kind of gave up this philosophical approach. And in fact, I said he only wrote one book, but he did write another book, which was a very tiny little dictionary for school children. So he had this other side to him, and it's really interesting, that last sentence, there are things you can't speak about. When his book began to gain fame, and he became, quickly after the publication of that book, he became very famous, a whole school developed, and they understood that to mean, if there's things that you can't put in language, you should just ignore them, just shut up. You know, don't talk about things that you can't put into language. And Wittgenstein, when he finally attended the meetings of that group, it was called the Vienna Circle, he got very upset. Wittgenstein was a very emotional man. I won't go into all the details, but he got very upset. And the story is that he said, "You people have completely misunderstood me. You're talking about the things that don't really matter." And he turned his back on the group and he started reading poetry by Rabindranath Tagore out loud while the group was meeting. So Wittgenstein, in a very real sense, exemplifies this romantic quality. There are things that language can't get to. And of course, meditation is very much connected to that sense. You know, there's this fundamental image, very important image in meditative practice of monkey mind. You know, the mind just races around from one thing to another, swinging from one branch to another. And you could say that the branches that it swings from are concepts and words and ideas, right? And it's just always doing that and never able to stand still. So you have to stop and let the mind slow down. Let the mind come to rest. And that is the domain of silence. And I think I'm talking about things that you all know about. Sudhi has a quote here: "I will throw word and sound and speech into confusion, that without these three I may converse with thee." That's Rumi. Yeah, that's very nice. And I was going to cite something else, which is actually in the Old Testament. It's in the Psalms. The Psalms say, "Be still and know I am God." So that quality of stillness is certainly connected to this idea of returning to the nameless. When we get into the body of the chapter, so far we've just been talking about the title of the chapter, we will see that the way that Rinpoche approaches it is, he raises some questions about our usual understanding of that. But for now, I think, let's just stay with that for a minute. And I like that formulation, "Be still and know I am God." I did a little research on that during the week, and at least one interpretation that's offered is very much in line with what we've been looking at, this idea of being still as meaning something like, stop listening to yourself and start listening to God, right? Or start listening to the silence, start listening to the deeper reality, stop trusting in yourself. So I thought that to start, and before we go into the discussion in the chapter, we could just experiment with that for a few minutes. Now, typically, if you say, "Okay, I want to be able to contact the silent mind," let's say, you would say, "Well, go on a meditation retreat," you know. But we're not going to do it that way. We're going to see what happens if we try for just a few minutes. And of course, that doesn't, because we're going to do it that way, that doesn't mean, you know, that we're necessarily going to be able to touch that deep inner silence. But the question is, what happens? So if we make it our practice now, just very simply, to be still, you know, for a few minutes here, how do we go about doing that? What happens in our experience when we set out to do that? And what kinds of difficulties do we find? And do we touch anything in our experience that seems to have that flavor of stillness, even if perhaps we don't feel we've reached the heart? So this is just, in a sense, a very naive exploration. We don't have any presuppositions. We're not going to do any specific practices. The question is just, what happens if we make that our intention to be still? So let's try that for a few minutes. Okay, let's come back together. And as always, I invite your comments, and we have a few comments already. So Klaus says, it's like putting the brakes on a rushing car. Yeah. So it's not, you know, the brakes have a kind of a, the image is maybe a little violent there, and I don't think that's the point. The point is the slowing down. How can you slow down? In a way, I suppose it would be more like putting the car in neutral and just letting it coast to a stop. I don't want to steal your image or distort it, but you know, if you think I've got it wrong, don't let me know. Don't tell me. Oh, Klaus says more. He added the second sentence. A sense of friction arises. Ah, well, okay, so you really do believe that, or you really are pointing out that there's something you have to do. I guess that's the braking action. A sense of friction arises, along with a momentum of mind's flow into the direction of thinking. So, okay, so I think what you're pointing to more is like the difficulty. It's like there's an image in one of the TSK books where Rinpoche says it's like, well, there's a couple of places. Once he talks about trying to stop a rushing train, a speeding train, and I think your image is a lot like that. But at one point he talks about he's talking about flying in a plane, and he says instead of trying to stop the plane, which you really can't do, you can just sit inside the plane. Well, that may go more in the direction of where this chapter also goes. But, okay, so you're saying there's something very difficult because the mind wants to move just like a car. Once it's going, once it's got the gas pedal down, wants to move. But Caroline says, finer levels of movement become apparent. Sounds become much clearer. So do you mean, Caroline, finer levels of movement of the mind or movement around you in the atmosphere or in the environment around you? Okay, let's go on. Okay, Caroline says, internal sensations in the mind. Okay. Yeah, I something I noticed that I thought was interesting was there's this kind of surface level of the mind moving where it's just going here and there, here and there, here and there, just picking on this, picking on that, noticing this, noticing that. And if you let that if you let that become more still, then you could say more meaningful thoughts come. You know, there's still thoughts, there's still language, there's still words, but they have to do with the concerns that really are engaging you. And then perhaps beneath that, you begin to tune in more to the sensory world around you. Or perhaps, as you say, Caroline, the sounds. Okay, David writes, what happens if we intend to be still? I react by taking a deep breath. That's always a good reaction, I think. Taking a deep breath, look away, widening the focus to include all sensing. I feel everything, my breathing steady. Just doing that is calming. It creates space in the mind, room. It's an expansive gesture. Surface mental activities trickle down. I become feeling-based, less thought-based. So you notice that as I read that, and this wasn't a deliberate choice, I just slowed down because that seems connected with what you're saying. Many years ago, I went to a talk by a Zen teacher, and the Zen center, Tassajara, at which he was teaching and was leading a retreat, actually, or leading a practice, burned down. And he described what went on, and this reminds me of it. He said he saw, at one point, he looked up and he saw this kind of wall of fire entering the meditation hall from behind. And he said, for a moment, he looked away, as you say, David, and he took a deep breath because he wanted to center himself and be ready to respond, which is very interesting that that was his response. He said then when he looked back or opened his eyes, the flames had gotten way bigger, and now it was like a big emergency. I don't know what to make of that, but it just struck me. Okay, Eliana says, in silence it is easier to watch the movements of the mind and the drive to label and interpret the experience. So that's related to what Caroline said, and I think it's great, you know, that sense. There are these different forms of momentum that are constantly driving the mind here and there, and the drive to label and interpret. If we can really contact that, we're in touch with something very fundamental to our understanding. Sudhi says, this stillness is like a boundless silence, yet awake and alert and alive, with no specifics in view, restful. Okay, so that is a theme that has come up. John says, like the space around and within thoughts, now the silence around and within thoughts. Yeah, that's a good connection to make. And phenomena. I've often thought about how the predominant nature of the universe is silence. The predominant nature of the universe is silence. Yeah, although, you know, I mean, certainly when we think of empty space, we think of silence, but you know, let's say we were near the surface of the sun, I imagine it'd be very noisy because there's all this energy going on. And yet that kind of noise, that kind of sound, it's a better word than noise, is perhaps not inconsistent with silence. And Philip, and Kathleen, a few deep breaths and then a slowing of thoughts, beating heart, it feels gentle and calm. Then the thought, the breath, takes it away. So I was just looking at something in Gesture of Balance this morning for another purpose, and you may remember he says it when he's talking, there's a chapter called Opening the Heart, and he says, feel your heart. He says, literally, feel your heart, feel the beating of your heart. That may be connected to the silence we're talking about. Philip says, I'm literally in a very noisy place, but the silence is surprisingly possible even so, and the surrounding noises do not interfere with the expansion of my mind into space and the slowing down of naming. Yeah, slowing down of naming, finding that momentum, letting it slow down. Back to this notion, there's a kind of a friction involved in that, back to Klaus's image. It's really valuable to see that. It's really valuable to see the push, the drive toward naming, and see perhaps that it slows down. Karin wrote privately, but she probably meant it to be for everybody, holidays for the working mind, only breathing, right? Holidays from this constant push, right? To name, to know. Michael writes, sitting with my eyes closed, I found some sounds relaxing. The sound of wind outside, the walls creaking, seemed to invoke an open world, rumbling in my gut, very close, but easy to incorporate into a sense of wholeness, like the meowing of my cat, the chiming of a clock in another room. Hardest were Jack's words. Sorry. No, it's true. Words are difficult, right? Because words invite us. They solicit us. They ask us to get involved in something that's not silent. Hardest were Jack's words after I was trying to disengage from a busy world, because they called forth the engagement of meaning in the mental activity that entails. Peaceful feeling seems to correspond to the sense of freedom to flow outwards and inwards without delineations intruding. And Ron wrote, felt like a nourishing womb, free floating. So floating in a nourishing womb, right? think that's the image. Okay, so we all, I think, appreciate this kind of experience, and perhaps you could say we covered it. So now I want to go into the chapter and look at how Rinpoche, what he has to say about it. Let me try to say that as neutrally as possible, what he has to say about it. So we start in the chapter with the role of words and names and concepts. Names and concepts, I'm looking just at the first paragraph, names and concepts identify qualities, and qualities get referred back to entities. So now there are things that are real, and now the world has been set up, and of course we have to respond to it, right? And it's not only that we have to respond to it, but that we are a part of the world, and we occupy a very specific place. And that's at the bottom of page 19, Rinpoche says, in this communication forward, we ourselves emerge in the role of manifestor. It's not really an English word, for those of you who wanted to look it up. We ourselves emerge in the role of manifestor, the one who knows. But though our role is central, okay, I'm sorry, I just got involved in reading it. I don't need to do that. So we become the manifestor. Let me break off for a moment. Karin asked if I could give the Wittgenstein citation in the orientation, and I will. I'll give that quote, and I'll give my translation. I've been playing with different translations of that for many years. So you'll get my current one. Okay. So, you know, this is really important because that is this notion that we are the ones who know. You know, I've said many times that it seems to me central in the TSK vision that knowledge is not the knowledge of a knower. It's not the property of a knower. The kind of knowledge that the TSK vision is talking about is something deeper, broader, more open than that. So what happens is that on the one hand, we identify a world, but on the other hand, we identify ourselves as the ones who know that world. So what that means is that the mind really has to work in a certain way. You know, it's the way things get set up, we really have no choice in the matter. You know? And so that's what it says at the top of page 20. We have no choice but to engage and participate, for the mind has no other way of working. That's how our mind gets set up. So I think we've mentioned in here before that Einstein once said that the greatest mystery was that our minds were constructed in such a way that we could understand the universe. But really, from a TSK perspective, it has to be that way. The mind and the universe arise together. We have the kind of mind that knows the kinds of objects that the mind identifies. And, well, I could go around that circle several times and I still wouldn't get to the heart of it, but I think we understand or we've done enough with that so we can talk about it. So that's our ordinary mind. Now, the problem with that is, there's many problems. It leads us into an unhappy way of being, you could say. But in terms of this question about returning to the nameless or about being still, what we were exploring in the discussion that we had, the exercise we did, and then the comments that people made on it. The difficulty is that the mind isn't set up for silence. You know, the mind is set up, and this is our ordinary mind we're talking about, the mind is set up to know in a particular way. And that's the only option we have. Right? So I was just reading at the top of page 20, Rinpoche says there, we cannot set aside some other time to let the mind find inner calm. I'm just going to stop there, because the sense is, well, can we settle into a kind of a calm and relaxed state? And it's interesting, you know, Rinpoche says no. We can't do that. Well, we say, but wait a minute, I just did it. Everybody, just, you know, the comments point toward the possibility of at least moving more in that direction. It doesn't mean that, you know, we arrive at perfect stillness or something like that, but at least moving more in that direction. So there is a kind of inner calm that we can arrive at. But I think what Rinpoche is suggesting here is that, you know, unless something very fundamental changes, we're going to move within a limited circle, within a limited range of possibilities. So, you know, let's say the mind has its understanding, and when I say mind here, I guess I really mean the ordinary mind, setting aside whether there's any other kind of mind besides ordinary mind, but the mind has its way of understanding calm. And so we cultivate a sort of inner calm, and we arrive at that inner calm. But can we be confident, let's say, that when we do that, we have stepped away from the world of names and concepts, or have we just arrived at a particular soothing place? It's like this image just came into my mind. It's like if you go into a shopping center, let's say, a shopping mall, and all around you there are people doing this and doing that, and people are trying to sell you things and so on. And somewhere in that mall there's a little booth where you can go and get a neck massage, right? And so you go and step into this booth, and for 10 minutes you get this neck massage. But then you leave, and you're right back in that same shopping mall. So the question is, have we ever, when we cultivate this kind of inner calm, how confident can we be that we've really moved away from the underlying structure? Or have we just identified this little space? We've given that a name. We say, that's the peaceful place, you know. It's you know, I think it's important to take that question seriously. And Rinpoche returns to that a number of times. Ron makes, points to something similar here, and in the chat box here he says, too much fixation on stillness. Maybe it's overrated, right? So I think Rinpoche is going to go kind of in that direction. We'll look at it. Ron continues, then thinking and thought become the evil enemies. Right, now you're going to create this dichotomy. It's a problem. Like, oh no, a thought, terrible. You know, what do I do with it? I have to get rid of it. A lot of hidden tension to maintain a contrived, enforced silence or calm. And I think that most people, who are experienced meditators do move beyond that. They accept thoughts and let them be. And as Philip said about the noise outside where he is sitting, or somebody else said something similar, it's not an enemy. The silence of the universe doesn't mean that nothing can be happening, even though sometimes people might think of it that way. So we don't need to be too concerned about thoughts, but we do need to be concerned, I think, about whether we're arriving at a place that is, you know, you could really say whether we've returned to the nameless. That's good. Just to stay with that. So, what can we do about that? Where, as Rinpoche says, we can't set aside another time, a different time. We're in our time. And it's the time of the world of names and things, even if it seems that we can withdraw for a time. Okay, so having raised that question, and Rinpoche will come back to it, but having raised that question, he says, well, you know, maybe instead we should be looking at the power of words. Let's see if I can find the right place here. The approach that he takes, so I'm going to summarize a little bit of the discussion here. The approach that he takes is, he says, well, look, you can think of words, or you can identify words as the ones that give you identities. Now we're stuck with those identities. But words are also the manifestation of the field communique. So now we're tying it back to that image, which came up in the last chapter. So on the top of page 21, he says, it's at the bottom of page 20. He's saying, okay, words are a problem, but at the very bottom of page 20, he says, this view is incomplete, for we all know from direct experience that words can evoke new knowledge and inspire new vision, can touch the heart and stir the spirit. And he links that then up to the power of the field communique. And when we get to that, I'm not going to comment on this because it would take too long, but there's a lovely line where he says, reality is the translation of words, concepts, and images into another dimension. So is that helpful? Does that give us a way to proceed? Before I answer that question, let me look at what Sudhi has written in the chat box. She says, isn't it true that to bring this inner silence, one needs to familiarize themselves with this state via practice? No amount of understanding, I think you mean here like rational understanding, will bring this familiarity into experience. Right, so how do we arrive at this inner silence? That really is what we're looking at. And one possibility is via practice. And I don't disagree at all. But it's not exactly the approach that Rinpoche is using right here, so I want to stay with where he's headed. He's talking about words, first of all. And he talks about poetry and the power of art. And he says, but you know, the problem with that is not everybody's a great artist. It's a rare event when a work of art can really evoke and inspire us. So then he says, well, what's another possibility? Another possibility, and this, of course, gets closer to what we were working with and gets closer to meditation, is he says, we can turn to experience directly. Right? This is in the last paragraph on page 21. He says, we can invite the immediacy of experience to open our senses. And in that way, we can activate a different kind of awareness. That's, you know, if you had to label that, I don't know if that's the point, since labels are in question here, but if you had to label that, you could say that really seems to be the meditative approach. It's not only meditative in the sense of saying, well, here's meditation on one side and here's TSK on the other side. It also comes up in TSK. You just think of a practice like marriage of sound and breath, for instance. That's a practice that evokes this kind of immediacy of experience. And I think in the TSK context, maybe in the meditative context, the value of doing that is that you relax the usual structure. You relax the way that everything is centered on the mind as the presenter, right? The manifestor, as he says. So new possibilities open up. And he suggests, and this is going, well, he suggests that you can also allow names to continue to operate. We could allow this, at the bottom of page 21, we could even allow this naming tendency to operate without accepting its conclusion as final. So we really give priority, you could say, to direct experience. Right? Okay, but now comes a very important point that Rinpoche makes here, and it's already come up, but he makes it more strongly here. He says at the top of page 22, he says, well, this approach offers a systematic methodology, and that's perhaps related to your point, Sudhi, that you need to practice. You know, so here we have a method, a methodology. This approach has the advantage of offering a systematic methodology that anyone is free to cultivate. Few people will be able to master it without extensive effort. And that is a really fundamental point. I think we underestimate, you know, and in the meditative traditions as they're being presented in the West, we underestimate the challenge of really following out the meditative path. You know, he says, few people are going to be able to do this without extensive effort. And he says that again on page 24. I won't read it. He says it really requires great effort. And then on page 25, he says, if we're aiming at that, it seems like what we're going to be able to accomplish is kind of momentary clearings in the mists of confusion. That's not quite his image, but it's very close. That's the problem that we face. We have this approach. It has the possibility of accomplishing a return to the nameless, to stay to that with that phrase. But it requires great effort to do that. It requires great effort to do that. So, and there's another point, which is that, and he talks about this briefly here, and I feel like I need to move along in these last few minutes. There's another point, which is that the very structure of going to experience still leaves a very fundamental set of labels and structures in place, and those are the labels of subject and object. Right? We think we're headed toward the immediacy of experience, but we always presuppose the notion that we're the ones who are doing it, we're the ones who are having the experience, and in principle it's possible to go beyond that, but again, it's very difficult. Right? So he says, there's this move that we make. It's sort of about 12 lines from the bottom of page 24. We know from such and such a perspective, and we direct our knowledge towards such and such an end. We move at once from insight to our own reactions, obscuring the initial clarity of experience. So even if there is this clarity, the silence of the universe, let's say, we won't let it rest. And we make the move towards our own reactions even within the meditative experience. So it becomes problematic to do that. And that's where the point where he says, yes, you can challenge that, you can overcome it, but only with great effort. Right? And he discusses that a little bit on 24 and 25. So we really, it's problematic. So what can we do about that? I'm just going to move toward the very end of the chapter. Maybe I'll come back and fill in a little bit more because we're out of time, but I'll fill in a little bit more in the orientation. But there is a way to do it, and the last section of the chapter is about that. And when I say it that way, I find myself thinking, well, you know, it's not as like, oh, now I'm going to reveal the secret, now we're going to know how to do it, just follow steps 1, 2, and 3. It's not like that. But the possibility is there, right? And the reason that they're there, it's there, is because we don't have to move outside the structures that seem to be blocking our appreciation, our ability to return to the nameless, right? We can return to the nameless, you might say, within names and structures and boundaries, right? So at the in the first full paragraph of on page 26, at the end of it, he says, when we adopt the specific identity, we inevitably adopt its boundaries and limits as well. But like the identities we affirm, these limits are constructs of knowledge. They cannot limit knowledge itself. Right? And that's the move. That's the you know, the TSK move, you could say. It doesn't matter what the limits are, because it's all an expression of knowledge. Or you could say it's all a presentation of time, or it's all the openness of space. That's where Rinpoche returns again and again and again. Now, as he says on the top of page 27, that's a kind of magical move, and you can't just get there. So Sudhi said before, well, don't we need to practice extensively? Well, we at least, if we don't do that, we at least need to be able to activate a new vision, which is what I would say is kind of the method in TSK, right? And he says we can't quite do that right now. It's difficult at this stage to evoke the magic that this way of being makes available. Right? He says we have to go before the present manifestation, before the before. Right? And that's where we're starting to head. And we do that, as he says at the bottom of that page, by tuning in to the field communique. Right? We don't accept what gets communicated. We tune in to the act or the activity of communicating. Right? And when we do that, we let go of our reliance on words and language. And then he says, and I guess maybe I'll stop there, he says we can touch the nameless and formless within appearance that make naming and giving form possible. And I won't quite stop there, because he says here it's a very lovely line on the last page of the chapter. He says, what appears traces the circle of zero, functioning shape and character out of openness. And again, for those of you who are not English, native English speakers, and look up function as a verb, it doesn't exist. Rinpoche is just using the word there. Functioning shape and character out of openness, without departing from zero, without requiring a body, the exhibition can serve the purpose. And then he says, how do we get there? Well, we have to open appearance to space, and that's where we're going to go in the next chapter. Let me just refer, I'm sorry I'm keeping you a little late. Ron says, and we're talking about this issue of meditation and you know, how difficult, he says, monastics have a great challenge with this, let alone us modern secularists, right? And John says, I think responding to Sudhi, reading the TSK books and deepening understanding also takes effort and time and practice. I think that's right. You know, studying TSK, it's not as though we say, well, that's an alternative. It's not something that's just sudden enlightenment, you know. It's a practice of its own. But it is a practice. It's a sort of moment-by-moment practice, which is one of the different characteristics. Okay. And Ron says, that phrase, direct experience, is vulnerable to superficial applications. And yes, that's exactly what we have been talking about. It's one of the themes we've been looking at this week. And comments that it sounds like knowledge is watery and fluid. So tuning in is like staying with the fluid quality of knowing, which freezes into names and identities. Yeah, and Rinpoche actually uses that image at one point, and it kind of underlines or repeats what we've been saying. You know, water is still water, whether it's frozen or flowing. And Rinpoche says, if we can touch, you know, it's like finding the water within what's frozen. We don't have to be caught up in the names. We can return to the nameless. And I really will stop there now. Thanks, everybody. And as you can see, we're embarked now on a great journey. We're getting ready. Here, the path, Rinpoche says, that we've been exploring returns us to our starting point. We arrive at the nameless and the formless by opening appearance to space. I like to end with a quote from Rinpoche because it always makes me sound smart. But I'm just quoting Rinpoche. Okay, see you next week. Bye-bye.